You are listening to Prometheus by Minute. I'm your host, Courtney Coulson. This is Minute 16. This minute opens with Fifield saying, "I'm here to make money," and ends with Wayland introducing himself. As Fifield sits at the table, his jacket is placed in front of him. We can see it's quite weathered, especially in the lining. I have a thing for seeing the inside of costumes. It so rarely happens. The jacket is one of the most unique in the film. There is a Japanese aesthetic, and it is one of the few costumes to have a print on it. This is definitely a civilian garment, and yet there are a series of patches on this jacket. As far as I can tell, none of them are Wayland-related. This may imply that he has been on other missions before with other companies. So, is he a freelancer? What about the rest of the crew? Their clothes all have Wayland patches, but there is nothing uniform about their costume. It doesn't make much sense that Wayland would manufacture such a wide variety of garments for their employees. You would expect something more along the lines of what is worn by the crew of the Covenant. I think on a visual level, this variety of costumes seen amongst the Prometheus crew helps to individualize them and make them memorable, and I love the way they look, but it's not exactly logical. It reminds me of the crew from Disney's Atlantis, sort of character-first, uniform is less of a priority. From what I can tell from the behind-the-scenes materials, the costume process was a bit improvised. The actors got to play around and try different things. I think the ideal solution was to either put them in uniforms or forego the patches altogether. They're in this weird middle ground where it's not a uniform, but it's not entirely civilian clothing either. Worse still, some characters seem to have opted for Wayland-issued clothing, like Shaw. She wears a flight suit, which I doubt she brought on the trip with her, while others are wearing whatever they want. It's not a huge complaint. I feel the costumes still succeed in informing us of their character, but it's just inconsistent. There's a great costume blogger, Hello Taylor, whom I have followed for many years. They echo my sentiments on this. I will link to their article in the footnotes. Here is a quote from Janti about the costumes from the art book. Ridley was quite adamant he wanted to avoid the puffy NASA spacesuit and move away from the spacesuit used in the original Alien. He also wanted to avoid the heavily futuristic uniform look for onboard wear for any cohesiveness within the crew. In actual fact, they are all wearing very similar clothing, but Ridley wanted them to look kind of messy and very casual. Spacesuit-wise, it was a little more difficult because we needed to avoid a superhero look. Ridley loves the skinny look of the NASA undersuits, which in the 60s were silver. We did a lot of research into biosuits, which are the cooling suits with all the tubes on the outside, the orange and blue one. He loved that look. It was more interesting, more technical. Plus, it gave the actors a lot more chance to be mobile. With Numi, we went through every single look. We went through the futuristic look, the Star Trek look, diagonals, Eastern looks. We came down to her wearing a flight suit, a la Sigourney. She looks terrific. Whatever she wears, she rocks, which, yes, I would agree. So I could imagine that Shaw has, just picked a standard issue Wayland garment. I don't think she's particularly fussed with her appearance. She's not a very vain person, so she, probably didn't pack much of her own clothing, just she was happy with whatever. The crew are assembled in the gym/basketball court to be briefed on the mission. They enter through a Star Trek-type door, one that slides up and down automatically. They look cool, but doors that slide inside the walls don't make practical sense in most structures, especially not in domestic houses. You actually have to use more space to accommodate them. That's all I think about when I see Corbin Dallas's apartment in The Fifth Element. You would have to have an apartment-sized space on either side of his apartment to store all the furniture and stuff in the walls. Like, where is this mass going? Of course, here on a massive ship, it's not so much of an issue, but it's a thing I think about. This debriefing scene is probably the first scene that is commonly complained about. I don't hear much criticism for the preceding 15 minutes, it's pretty perfect. The problem people have is why are they having this discussion after they've arrived at their destination instead of before? But I will defend this one. I think it makes perfect sense. This was an important mission. It had to be kept secret. What if someone changed their mind and pulled out at the last moment? Then they're a security risk. Also, it would have been hard to convince people to go on a mission like this if they were told they were essentially going to look for God. From a storytelling perspective, it's more economic too. In the script, we have to take a bit of a detour with Shaw and Holloway, having a meeting with Wayland. Here we just jump straight into the plot. I honestly don't find it that hard to imagine people agreeing to basically anything if the price is right. Sure, a 5-year mission into uncharted territory across space sounds crazy and scary to us, but if Feifel's jacket or Ravel and Chance's banter is any indication, this isn't unusual in this world. What is unusual is the secrecy, and maybe even that isn't all that uncommon. Everyone here seems to be very used to this environment. Speaking of Ravel and Chance, they have a bet over whether or not this is a terraforming mission. This is reminiscent of Parker and Brett and the bonus situation. You know, both are referenced multiple times in the film, sort of this subplot. I feel Alien was so influential over cinema that came after it that when I noticed Alien references in Prometheus, I almost overlooked them because they've just become such universal tropes. So David is fiddling around with the lighting through his tablet. He then turns and tends to Shaw and no one else. He kind of guides her to her seat. I never realized how much they were trying to tie these characters together before. It's ridiculous, we're only 16 minutes in. They haven't even really had a conversation yet. In scenes like this, where there are characters talking in the background, I often wonder what they're talking about. And, being the researcher I am, I decided to look into it and found an interesting article. Ken Miyamoto, produced screenwriter, former Sony Pictures script reader, story analyst, former Sony Studios liaison, and former movie extra says, "Nothing. They are saying nothing. I was an extra when I first moved to LA years ago. I worked on Traffic, Moonlight, Mile, Bedazzled, and others. Most of the time they are pantomiming, which means that not a vocal word is coming from their mouth at all. Rather, they are simply mouthing words while matching them with physical movement. And 9 times out of 10, it's gibberish, random and unplanned. Many times, they are mouthing typical conversation phrases like, really? Oh, cool, I know, yeah, not really, you know, things along those lines. When the director starts a scene and they are shooting, the only people talking are the principal actors with dialogue and any secondary that interacts with them. Extras are directed to pantomime so as not to interfere with the sound being recorded of the principals on set. There are exceptions. Robert Altman was famous for having multiple dialogues going on throughout a scene, where the camera mic would move to this part of the room and to that. But a majority of the time, it is all pantomiming. It even goes beyond dialogue. Ever see movie scenes set at a dance or anything equivalent? 9 times out of 10, those extras in the background are dancing to no music, which sounds like hell. So awkward. It sounds like a terrible job. There you have it. That's what extras are doing. Everyone sitting in this meeting is slouching. They're obviously, you know, not 100% from having just woken up from cryo. But David and Shaw have straight postures. Again, this is trying to tie them together, right? God damn it, Ridley, stop making me ship them. I don't ship them, it's pretty gross and inappropriate. The hologram Wayland is exactly the kind of unnecessary theatrics I would expect from him. In the background, we see Wayland's terraforming colony on Mars. As previously mentioned, this was going to play a more significant role in the film, but was cut due to budgetary constraints. However, we do see vehicles that will later be used on the Prometheus mission, so while it is a brief glimpse, it is a bit of world-building. The furniture in Wayland's office is red. It is one of the rare times the colour is used in the film. I think this was chosen to make this holo-projected environment stand in stark contrast to the blue gymnasium. The furniture is gorgeous and 60s space age. Thankfully not Eames-style stuff like it was going to be in the space script. I'm really not a fan. I couldn't find the name of a specific designer, but it's more along the lines of Arne Jacobsen or Henrik Thor Larsen. Also, why are all furniture designers Danish? I mean, some of them are Japanese, but mostly Danish. The most curious feature in Wayland's office is a giant statue that looks like a scribbly silhouette of a man. Scaramouche, yeah. You were thinking it, I was thinking it. It casts an uncanny shadow on the wall to the right, directly above Vickers. The only explanation I can come up with is that it is supposed to evoke the Uncanny Valley. Considering Wayland is the creator of synthetics, I suppose it makes a kind of sense. But we also see a giant statue, the statue of David, in Covenant, in the opening scene. Evidently, Wayland likes to surround himself with things that make him feel important, be they rare, significant, expensive, or in this case, just physically big. Wayland is followed by a little dog. A dog David no doubt had to groom. I think this shows Wayland's desire for a creature that is completely obedient and loyal to him. I don't think he would have been fond of cats, as they can't be controlled the same way. Also, that brings our dog count to 2. This is very important to me. Dogs are very important. I wish Jonesy was a dog. Then I would, you know, actually care. Not a fan. We see Wayland in a Nehru suit, presumably made of the same ridiculously expensive fabric Vickers' suit is made of. I didn't go into much detail on that in the previous episode, so I will elaborate more on that here in a moment. But the Nehru jacket is a formal garment that originates from India. Considering Wayland is supposedly Anglo-Indian, having been born in Mumbai, it makes sense. Additionally, it is another 60s-inspired design choice, and on top of that, the Nehru suit is the outfit of choice for many villains in James Bond and Doctor Who. So this really was a well-chosen design. We get everything we need to know about Wayland from this one jacket. So, more info on the vicuña fabric. Vicuña comes from a kind of llama of the same name, which is only found in higher altitudes in South America. They are rare, and cannot be kept in captivity as they starve themselves to death. So, once a year they are rounded up and shaved, then sent back into the wild. Now, that would be one thing, but they also happen to have the finest, which is to say thinnest, hairs in the world, making for the softest and warmest wool on Earth. Understandably, the material is ridiculously expensive. It's hard to determine how much Vickers' suit would have cost. I can say they probably needed around 4 meters, as for the exact cost per meter, the price varies. You know, it's not like a standard wool or something that you would buy from any fabric store or wholesaler. But from what I can tell, you can be looking up to $1,000 per meter. Just for comparison, you could buy enough leather for 3 or 4 large men's jackets for $1,000. I just don't understand why they decided to invest that much of the budget into these suits. I mean, they are amazing, don't get me wrong, but literally a fabric the tenth of the cost would probably have read the same on camera. Like, you know, wools and suiting fabrics that are around $100 per meter. I mean, that's expensive stuff. That's really nice stuff. And in a movie, no one can tell. It's just, it's madness. I can't fathom. Why? I should say, I could not find whether or not Wayland's suit was made of the same stuff. It looks similar. It might not be. Who can say? By contrast, David's Mao suit is made more cheaply. It is clearly a cheaper fabric, and it is constructed more simply. It's not lined, for example, the hems are just rolled hems and so on. In fact, I'm surprised the trousers, it's a blind hem, it's not a top-stitched hem, so at least there's that. This costume rightly suggests that he is subordinate. I love a Mao suit, or a Zongshan suit, and it has a fascinating cultural history. It has, in the past, been a symbol of oppression and of rebellion. There's a really great article by the BBC on that, which I will link to in the footnotes. I don't really have time to go into the complete history of it, but in David's case, I think it is to evoke the uniform worn by civilians in communist China. At the same time, David was modelled after David Bowie. Wonder if that's where he got his name, can't find any particular confirmation on that. But Bowie, among other rock stars, were known to don a Mao suit on occasion. Again, another reference to the 1960s. There are so many layers of meaning in these costumes. While the lack of consistency among the crew is a bit of an issue, Janty clearly knows what she's doing, and there are many wonderful, thoughtful costume choices throughout the film. So, I want to talk a bit about Wayland's age. He is supposedly around 100 here, and he looks absolutely ancient. Given that he is from my generation, the current consensus seems to be that the first person to live to 150 is already alive. Not only that, but there are a number of cures for aging that are being trialed right now that seem very promising. They might not totally cure aging, but they may delay the effects. There's a good, now let's see if I can pronounce this, Kurzsacht, video on it, which I will put in the footnotes. Wayland is a man obsessed with immortality. With boundless resources and determination, he invented faster-than-light travel. He invented a machine to look inside people's minds, and perfected androids, just to name a few things. And you're telling me this guy didn't invest in any medical or cybernetic backup plans to extend his own life? I get that from a storytelling perspective, it's more powerful to show how frail and ancient he is, rather than having him look younger and healthier. But I feel like the twist that he was still alive but had to remain in cryo and only invest in this mission for selfish reasons could still work. If he still looked, you know, relatively young, about the same age he did in the opening of Covenant, having done all he could to extend his life, but then suffering from dementia or some other kind of degenerative disease. I don't have a problem with the way things are in the film, I just feel like it would have been truer to Wayland's character to have him preserve himself by any means necessary, and then face the irony of his mind deteriorating late in his life. I think that's a much more interesting story to explore. Plus, you know, no distracting makeup. I'm sure Guy Pearce would have liked all those hours of his life back. That's another thing people complained a lot about is, oh, why did you cast a young guy to play an old guy? And what was with the old age makeup? Which I think the makeup's fine. It's one of those things, it's very hard to push that out of the uncanny valley. You will always be aware, well, that's Guy Pearce. I know he doesn't look like that. Well, originally in the script, which I suppose we'll get to at some point, there's a scene where you go inside Wayland's dream, and he's still a young man. So that was the only reason they needed to cast a young person, younger person for the role. But they sort of made good use of Guy Pearce in Covenant. So yeah, no, I'm glad they... Well, I think Pearce is amazing as Wayland. I just love his character so much. He's such an arrogant, larger-than-life bastard. He's great. I hope they do make use of him again. If there is a third film, I know I talk about that a lot, there will be a third film, dammit, and it will have Guy Pearce. Now, before I go, just a bit of behind-the-scenes stuff. There are certain minutes that I watch, and my mind is a complete blank the first time I watch it. You know, I don't see anything worth commenting on, but I have this self-imposed 5-minute minimum per episode. You know, I don't want to waste an episode. I really want to delve into something worthwhile. I want my listeners to come away having learned something. Essentially, I am watching a minute 10, 12, 20 times. And without fail, I do find something to talk about. This film really has a lot to offer. And I'm really realizing that the further into this series I get. So the scripts for my episodes are essentially essays, about 2 or 3 pages long, which is about 1,000, 2,000 words. And, you know, I wish I could churn out essays that fast when it came to my university work, but I think it just goes to show that paying close attention and really thinking deeply can be rewarding. And that's why I love the Movies by Minute, so thanks Star Wars Minute guys for thinking of it. Alright, that about covers it. This is Coulson signing off. You can find me on TravianDesigns.com, TRAVIAN, or Prometheus by Minute on Facebook. On the Facebook page, I do share articles and stuff that might be of interest to you all, and then there will be footnotes on the Travian Designs website. I've probably mentioned that before. So yes, plenty of supplementary material for you all. Don't say I don't give you anything.